Welcome to a special edition of Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily podcast. A few months ago, the government unveiled plans for an extraordinary new RAF combat aircraft, the Tempest. Now, depending on which reports you believe, it will be able to fire bursts of particle beams and have a cockpit so digitally advanced it can fit in a pilot's helmet. That's, of course, if it needs a pilot at all. So, is this the future of British air defence? What's the thinking that led to the inception of this project? Can we really afford it, and should we be attempting one at a time where the future of defence spending is very highly fought over? I'm Fraser Nelson, editor of The Spectator, and I'm delighted to be joined by the defence analyst Douglas Barry, Air Vice Marshal Peter Rochelle, otherwise known as Rocky, who's the RAF's Chief of Staff Capability, and Sir Roger Carr, Chairman of BAE Systems, which is kindly sponsoring this podcast. Now, Sir Roger, I'll come to you first. BAE is behind Tempest, along with a consortium of other companies. We've got Rolls-Royce for the engines, MBDA, the European missile maker, and Leonardo of Italy as sensor specialists. But why are the four of you together for this? Because there are other competing aircraft. Franco-German project was recently put together without Britain's involvement. So is this our response?
Well, I don't know about a response. I mean, we have a history, of course, of leading in this area. And the capability that this country has, together with its partners that you've outlined, is probably second to none. So there is an evolution here from the current aircraft, which is Typhoon, into the next generation, where we have the skills, the ability, and the support, importantly, of government, of trade unions, of business partners generally, to build something which is going to be absolutely at the cutting edge of technology.
And to put this in perspective, the Tornado was phased out a few months ago, so there are now no more Tornadoes in the RAF. The Typhoon will be here until the mid to late 2030s, and we're looking at a sort of sixth generation aircraft to come in around that time to eventually take over from the Tycoons, is that right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we're looking at a final investment decision around about 2025. We're looking at an aircraft right about 2035. And the Typhoon itself is continuing to evolve. This isn't an aircraft that stopped evolving. The technology we're developing for Typhoon, many of that such, will migrate onto Tempest and beyond. So it's a continuing technological development where the sort of heartbeat of capabilities in this country.
Okay. And can you say a bit more about what we've been reading in the press reports? I mean, there are reports of it being able to fire laser beams.
Well, I think some of what it can do is obviously going to be classified. But if you look at the future generally of fighting capability, lasers are an important part. Stealth is important. Laser capability is important. The use of artificial intelligence increasingly at the heart of new technology in the air. So all those things will give it a firepower and a capability that's unrivaled.
Now, Douglas Barry, it's unusual that Britain would do this by itself. We did the jump jet Harrier back in the 60s. But for a project of this size, I mean, particle laser beams and all of that, don't you normally need many countries to do this? I mean, right now we've got, sure, the coalition partners, Leonardo of Italy, but wouldn't you need another country like Sweden or something, or probably two or three others, to give this critical mass?
My view on this is that, in fact, if the UK attempts to do this alone, it won't happen. And I don't think there's actually any genuine aspiration for the UK to run a standalone programme completely from inception to fielding. I think given the scale of the project, the technology demands, the costs associated, this will occur, if it occurs at all, in a cooperative structure. And you mentioned the Swedes. The Swedes are very definitely interested. The Italians are in the orbit as well, as it were. And you've also mentioned that there is a Franco-German project which is running in parallel at the moment. The thing I've got to continue to remind myself is that when the previous generation of combat aircraft projects in a European context began in the mid-1970s, there were a number of structures which were mooted, you know, a three-nation programme, a four-nation programme, a five-nation programme. It took about a decade for all of this to shake out. So from the mid-1970s to 1985, you got a different number of different constellations of countries involved before it eventually settled down. And somewhat inefficiently, you ended up with three projects.
Right. Now, Rocky, when I was growing up, my dad was in the RAF, and he had an expression for something that was never going to happen. Come the revolution and the Mark III Nimrod, he would say. In other words, there's some things people talk about for a long, long time. Now, and before they actually happen, the nature of aircraft is they take decades, things like this to happen. But is it a bit of a stretch for Britain to be talking about this now, when we've got, by some estimates, a sort of £5 billion hole in the current defence budget? That's what the National Audit Office says, and for our current capabilities. Would we have the money to do this? Because we are talking about not just the £2 billion the government's promised up front, but a lot more. I imagine the Typhoons were £17 billion, it might be a lot more. Is our defence spending big enough for us to be embarking, credibly embarking, on a project of this size and ambition?
Well, I think you touched on the actual answer in your final point, ambition. Mm. So it does depend on how you see yourself in the world. In a post-Brexit society, what does it look like from a UK perspective? Can you afford for us to let our industrial base atrophy away? And certainly from the issues that Douglas picked up on around the threat basis has changed. The initiation for this, and this is this initiation of this programme happened quickly. I mean, we've been having a stately dance around what would the future look like, but we announced in Farnborough last year, it was only a year and a week prior to that, that we approached the boss and said, we have to have a different perspective here. We'd have to have a different view. We took that forward to the previous Secretary of State and the Prime Minister, and we addressed the issues. And a year later, we announced and demonstrated the full-scale replica capability at Farnborough. We're working at pace. We instigated the Rapid Capability Office to challenge ourselves on how we did acquisition, to answer a lot of those questions that you've just posed, which is, can you afford to do this? And my hypothesis would be is, well, at the front end of this programme, you definitely can do this. Can you use that money that was announced by the previous Secretary of State, the £2 billion, yeah. Can you use that wisely? This is a partner relationship with contribution from industry and from the MOD at the same time. It's also about the process that you should use in the RCO. People and sceptics didn't think that we would be able to get to the contract time when we made the announcement. Not only did we hit the announcement at Farnborough, we hit the heads of terms timescales, and we hit the contracting time. So the approach within the RCO is you can. What is it that you have to do to allow you to deliver this success and how you move forward?
But it is fair to say, is it not, that there has been a debate for quite a long time as to whether Britain should even be doing this, or whether, because let's remember, the aircraft that we're doing now, the F-35s, they're American. So some would say, look, it's time for Britain to accept that we should be content with making parts for the F-35 rather than making our own aircraft. And surely that would give you the best value for money. To which you would talk about, I imagine you'd respond about the ambition you said before. Do we want to be world leaders? We can be world leaders. But you've also said about the risk of our manufacturing base or our aerospace industry atrophying unless we manage to keep up this capability.
So these things are mutually supporting. The fact is that the core skills that reside in the UK presented the opportunity for us to be positioned the way that we have positioned in the F-35 programme that has brought the support contracts to the UK on F-35 in the manner that they have, and why the UK has had influence in the design of the F-35. So for me, from a military capability perspective, I'm looking at make sure that my lineage from today and into the future remains strong. I can't have an industry that just atrophies away because I need to continue to upgrade Typhoons on the way through. And these are mutually connecting to past to the future on the way through. And it goes around. So, but it also presents opportunity for me. It gives me a situation where we can have future conversations with any partners so that we can decide downstream the direction of travel as we move forward. But some of those international partners have been spoken about.
I mean, Sir Roger, I imagine that there will be parliamentary debate thinking, look, the defence budget is so stretched, wouldn't it be cheaper to buy American jets? Can you talk a bit about the importance of this to British industry? Is it the case that unless we embark on a project like this, then we are in danger of losing our ability to design combat aircraft? But also, does that really matter nowadays, because we're not in a Cold War sort of dogfighting environment? How important is it that we keep the sort of skills that we've had for the last few decades, because the defence environment has been rather different, perhaps, to the one that we're facing in the next decade or so?
Yeah, look, the defence environment is always changing. but the need for a skill set in the country is a constant. So if you pick at some of Rocky's points, you know, whilst we're great innovators, which we are in all areas, but in aerospace particularly, we're very good collaborators. So, you know, we've collaborated with the Americans mm-hmm. for the F-35. We make 15% of that aircraft, and we do it extremely well and are pleased to be part of the program. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be leading in when we look ahead to the next generation. And if you look purely on an economic basis, you commented on the Typhoon. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Typhoon, $15 billion probably to build it, $30 billion in terms of the sales we've actually made since that time. If you go back further in time to something like the Hawk, which mm-hmm. was it's a terrific world-beating plane and has been for many years, you know, probably $1 billion and something like $11 billion in return. So there's an economic argument.
Well, so in other words, you're saying that the chances of the British government getting its money back yeah. in the investment are pretty high in your opinion.
Yeah, because what we produce are first-class, absolutely cutting-edge aircraft, and people buy them and are pleased to have them. And we intend to continue to do that, but we will do it in partnership. And the point that's been made about the need not only for technical collaboration but financial collaboration is part of the future. Mm. And I think you look at the skills that we have, you look at the fact we employ probably over the supply chain upwards of 100,000 people. This is a very important part of UK. I mean, GDP, $3 billion, export sales, $1.5 billion every year. These are material contributions to the economic health of the country. But what's being developed are very significant aircraft, which are important to the security of the country. So good combination and a good sense of purpose on both levels.
Now, Douglas Berry, of course, nothing in defence is a simple materialistic consumption equation here, because where you make your defence decisions, you have to align that with your foreign policy decisions. I mean, we are quite close to the Americans. That has been the bedrock of our defence strategy ever since the end of the Second World War, pretty much. And right now, when we align with the Americans with the F-35, that has cemented that link. We've seen in the Franco-German, when they're talking about their new aircraft, they do talk, especially Airbus, in terms of it being important that Europe has its own capabilities. And I think they explicitly say, so we don't have to go anywhere near the F-35. If Britain wanted to go down this road and create a tempest with partners as yet to be undisclosed, isn't the only way we could finance this by actually getting out of our commitment to buy so many F-35s from the Americans? I think we're down to buy something like 138. I think we've actually signed up for 45 or 50. We haven't said we'll buy any more. Isn't it simply the case that we can't afford to buy any more if we want to proceed and spend the money that we would do on the Tempest?
There are lots of moving parts in your question. At the moment, I think the 48 aircraft are F-35Bs, so that's the minimum number, basically, that have been acquired to provide a carrier strike capability. There is discussion within ministry as to whether the follow-on order or follow-on orders are more Bs or a mix of As and Bs. The A would be is a land-based derivative, which would be specifically for the Air Force rather than for a joint force. In terms of how this plays out, I think it very much depends on how the relationship with the US develops and how the relationship with Europe develops.
Mm, interesting.
The numbers game, I think we've already seen indications that the Air Force thinks it's dialed back too far in terms of the number of combat aircraft it can put in the air. In 1990, the Air Force had probably around 500 fast jets. Today, depending on how many figure you want to pick, it's, you know, five squadrons of Typhoons and one squadron of F-35 standing up. Right. It's a far, far smaller force, and the argument is that, you know, mass has a value all of its own, so actually building up from that is important, and there are already signs that that's beginning to happen. You know, extending the life of early variant Typhoons to form two new squadrons is part of that.
Now, Rocky, at last year's Air Power Conference, you said something that jumped out to me. Why aren't we doing acquisition, you asked, like Google or Elon Musk? Now, isn't the answer there because there is nothing more political than defence acquisition?
So I would argue that we've started that change.
You're saying they make decisions quickly, they've got a higher tolerance of error.
Yeah, but we're doing that. So let me talk to you. So the RCO was, you know, so we've had some fast programs. You'll have heard about us launching our Carbonite 2 with Surrey Satellites. We acquired the money within the last week of a planning round. We put it on contract within the space of a week. The RCO currently has a contracting average time of something like 6 weeks at this moment in time. So we are finding mechanisms that allows us to respond and re-gear ourselves and take all that is good that we see out in the commercial world and try to bring it in. And there's a lot more that you will hear about as we go forward on these successes. You'll have heard about the program that we did with Leonardo and BrightCloud. They're a key important partner on terms of Tempest. And there are many others. Secretary of State made some announcements that you've heard recently mm-hmm. about swarming UAVs. You'll hear more about that.
Swarming drones, yeah, absolutely.
You'll hear about that.
So in other words, you think you can break the curse of defence procurement?
We have. Not only we think, we have.
Okay. Well, bold. Really, have you?
Yeah.
Insofar as you went to manage to get to the stage that we're at, normally it takes a lot longer to get. But we're still at the scoping phase, are we not?
Yeah, of course we are. So the important thing in the Levine review, which was to disaggregate the responsibility for acquisition closer to the frontline commands. Now, mm-hmm. I sit with an 11-page mandate from my boss, mm-hmm. and it is pretty clear-cut what it is that I'm supposed to achieve. We own part of the process, and therefore we can examine how we ask questions of ourselves and how we move forward. I take it personal mm-hmm. if we are failing in acquisition, because that is my job.
Okay. So, Roger, can you tell us a bit more about what Britain does better than everybody else? I mean, these things, of course, are famously, sometimes notoriously international. I think that the one wing of the Typhoon is built near Turin, the other wing is built near Madrid. I mean, right now we're making the back end of the F-35s, aren't we, in Britain? Where is Britain at or near the front when it comes to defence design, manufacture?
Well, I think historically, I mean, we've had leadership roles in all of those areas. And I think, you know, the skills of design and development are very much embedded in this country.
Because this is something that we can't really... One of the big questions is we don't want to lose things to, like, new players like China, even like Turkey are coming in behind. So we need to compete at the design phase. Like, is that the argument?
Well, yeah, we do. And that is where we do compete. I mean... The innovation that I accept it's innovation and collaboration, it's also a sense of partnership. And you have to have all of those things. And no one country, whoever they are today, can take from soup to nuts a brand new aircraft design and turn it into a saleable product.
Not even the Americans?
I don't think even the Americans. I mean, you need a sort of breadth of knowledge and skill and balance to do that. The Americans are probably the most able financially. Mm. But, you know, they value the contribution that we have made technically in the F-35 as an important partner. So doability, but actually desirability. For the Americans, I think it's been good to have a number of people at the table. You know, we haven't got the financial firepower to do it, but we have the technical capability to lead. And the interest that has been generated since Farnborough, where people have come to our door as a nation to say, we want to be part of this. In fact, we want to be part of this in a very significant way. And we see it as something that we can commit to, both technically and financially, to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is hugely encouraging. But it reinforces the sense of partnership that exists now between industry, government, and a recognition that only by working together mm-hmm. with everybody's skin in the game and everybody focused on the plan can this turn into the world-beating aircraft we believe it will be.
And can you talk a bit about the new technology that a sixth-generation aircraft could have? Not what the Tempest will have, but the kind of things that are in discussion. For example, the pilot helmet, which will allow what X-ray style vision so he can see, look as if the rest of the plane wasn't there.
Yeah, and the whole of the evolution of this product, really. I mean, there is a platform which has to be capable electronically of moving rapidly with the technology of the rest of the world. Mm. So this isn't a solid airframe that has to change. It's a capability to command electronic capability, artificial intelligence, that makes it able to be not only a piloted aircraft, but one that can run with other aircraft in parallel that are not piloted.
Right, so the pilot could be sitting somewhere controlling it remotely as drones are controlled today.
Could be, but certainly could be flying an aircraft, but controlling around that aircraft others are part of a battle squadron, which are not piloted other than through one man and the artificial intelligence that he commands. So man in the loop, not just aircraft flying without anybody, but a capability that doesn't exist today, but where the technology exists today for us to offer it for the future. I think that's fair, Rocky, don't you?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, some of the stuff that the swarming UAVs work that we're looking at is part of that informing. Within the RCA, we're running a program called Project Lanka.
That's so, Rocky, can you say a bit more about what swarming means to the newbie?
So what you're trying to do is to make sure... So most people, when the kids go and get their Christmas present and it's a drone, they're sitting there on a control stick for themselves and they're flying it from point A to B and they're interacting with it. The aim of the game with swarming drones and UAVs is that you can get them to work as if they are one part of one brain and that they are going to mutually support each other to generate a range of effects. So they may go up into a target area, ascertain where the target is for themselves, and then decide on actually how that target is going to be prosecuted or whether or not you're going to put in a cyber effect or a jamming effect or an EW effect. So that whole range, it is aimed to do that. That requires these things to be wired, to be intuitively talking to each other and communicating with each other throughout that.
Okay. And Douglas Barry, can you talk a bit about the other side here? Because every aircraft is designed with what we think the other guys are going to have. In this context, I imagine Russian and the Chinese are the only potential adversaries of technology to do this. But what kind of technology do we hear is being developed elsewhere? I mean, to what is this a response? I mean, just because one can produce all of this cutting-edge, expensive technology, it doesn't mean to say you necessarily should, unless you think there's a realistic chance of it being deployed in a defence or an offensive capacity.
I think, well, you mentioned the two prime suspects in Russia and China. Russia, the traditional enemy, in inverted commas, as the Soviet Union, and that was the pacing threat for decades and decades. Today, in terms of where the technology is coming from, it really is China. The Chinese have, over the past quarter of a century, covered an enormous amount of ground in terms of design and development, manufacturing, the amount of intellectual and financial capital that they have pushed into defence aerospace is remarkable. You see that in the kinds of aircraft that we're now expecting to see enter service. Probably 2020, we will see the first genuine low observable Chinese combat aircraft in frontline service.
And what might that look like compared to, say, one of our Typhoons that just came off the production line in Britain?
The J-20 is a big aeroplane. It's got canards, and which always reminds me of a US Air Force general's comment about the best place for canards was in somebody else's stealth aircraft, not his, because he didn't like them. There is a Russian influence there to some extent, probably at the start of the program, where they may have had some design support out of Russia, but this is predominantly, you know, this is made in China. It's a capable platform, as far as we can tell. It's got a lot of very capable weapons coming down the pipe to go along with it. Initially, what we've seen are medium to long range air-to-air weapons. We would expect that they will see pretty similar batch air-to-surface weapons in this aircraft. It's big. Even by Chinese terms, it's going to be expensive. So how many they get into service, I think, is going to be an interesting debate. It's not the only combat aircraft that the Chinese have got in development. They have a next-generation bomber, which we expect to see rolled out in the next 1 or 2 years, perhaps. There's possibly another strike fighter coming down the line. The US has just alluded to this in an open-source document. So you've got all of that to kind of take into consideration as perhaps the pacing threat. And then you can't forget what's happening in Moscow. Putin basically said that my previous plan to slow down production of my next generation fighter aircraft, the Su-57, which they'd actually taken the numbers down, they'd slowed the programme, he's changed his mind. And he's now saying, well, actually, I'm going to take about 70 in the next decade or so. In fact, we'd expected that he was only going to take probably only a squadron's worth just to try the aircraft out. That's all changed. Oh, and by the way, the previous, in Russian terms, the Su-27 Flanker, the latest variant of that, the Su-35S, is a pretty capable combat aircraft. It's as good a fourth-generation platform as the Russians have fielded.
All right. And are there any indications that the Chinese are managing to go through this process quicker than we are? I mean, Rocky's talking about the RAF doing procurement like Google or Elon Musk are certainly closer to them than how we've done historically. Now, we in Western democracies have always got the problem. We need to win votes as well as to win wars and to win export orders. The Chinese government don't have that handicap. So are we seeing them able to go from concept to production at a significantly faster pace than we are able to in the West?
Probably not, but they have a different... They have their own version of smart acquisition, if you like, which has been basically to cherry pick where they could, either overtly, and if they couldn't get technologies overtly, they'd try and get them covertly. So in the 1980s, they looked to the West to some extent. That was closed down by Tiananmen Square. They then looked to Israel. And in the 1990s, they really had access to Russian technology because of the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Russians were willing to sell pretty much anything tactical. They wouldn't sell strategic weaponry, but the Chinese had huge access to tactical stuff. They then tried covertly to hoover up as much as they could out the West. And they've been very canny in where they would place young academics in Western institutes to look at a whole range of technologies applicable in the defence aerospace sphere. So they've moved arguably much quicker than one would expect, given where they were coming from. The Chinese Air Force in the 1980s was really a kind of museum piece of Soviet-era equipment designed in the 50s and 60s. Today, you look at the PLAAF, the Chinese Air Force, and it really is a pacing threat. The capabilities they have and the capabilities we're projecting them to have out over the next 1 to 2 decades is significant.
I think the point that you make about what is happening elsewhere, when you listen to the checklist of what is happening in China, what is happening in Russia, the state of sort of the whole geopolitics at the moment, not to have this capability is unthinkable. We have to equip ourselves with a capability that is leading edge, absolutely up to speed, so that we can stand proud in a market where historically we've had a very strong position in aircraft, but where from both a security and a prosperity point of view, we have to have a position in the future. This isn't a choice. We must go forward.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.